Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking Ref, 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 the Queen's Speech, and everything John Blake said at Access All Areas. It's all coming up.
I genuinely read Wonky every day. I love it. But I do feel that I could announce that every HE provider should give every student a bag of gold, and there would half an hour be later a Jim Dickinson article that's said, has John Blake considered the terrible impact this will have on inflation? So I think there's not an infinite array of things we could have considered in the variations, but clearly cost of living and an appropriate financial support is one of the things the APP process is there to do and to weigh up. And I think we will look at that.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach. And joining me to untangle the knotted ball of HE policy this week are three brilliant guests as usual. In Canterbury, we've got Carl Igo, Vice-Chancellor of Arden University. Carl, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I was watching the Queen's speech on BBC, and the studio debate was led by my former law student, who's now a shadow Secretary of State, and they were debating constitutional law and the proposed new Bill of Rights. So as a professor of law, that made me feel very proud and very old.
And in the heart of Northampton, it's Sian Waring, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at the University of Northampton. Sian, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Mark. It'll be this evening, I think, the Student Teaching and Representation Award that the Student Union runs, and I'm giving an award for staff innovation in research.
And in her last appearance before going off on mat leave, it's Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Debbie, your highlight of the week?
It has to be our Access All Areas event on Tuesday, and I guess a personal highlight for me was just, you know, getting through the day without giving birth.
That was an achievement. Yes, we're all pleased to see. Now, we start the week with the massive news that the ref results are out. Debbie, tell us how we got here.
Well, so this is delayed ref 2021 results. Came out this morning. Everyone will be, universities, of course, had their results earlier in the week and have had the chance to crunch the numbers, draft their press releases and spin what's come out. But actually, I think the big news story here is, the enormous scale of really high quality research that's going on across the UK. So, 84% of the research that was assessed was rated as either world leading or internationally excellent. And one of the kind of consequences of some of the changes that we've seen since the last ref, is that excellence is spread even more widely, you know, both outside the Russell Group and outside of London. Although, as you would expect, you know, the most research-intensive universities continue to perform incredibly well. Things that have changed since the last time is all research active staff were required to submit, and every area in which a university is active, so every subject area or unit of assessment in REF language, we're obliged to submit something. There's a bit more variability in the number of things that people needed to assess, and that sort of helped to take account of things like people who might have had a career break or gone off on maternity or parental leave, and that kind of thing. And the impact and environment measures, so those unfamiliar with REF may not be aware that there are basically three things that you're measuring. You're measuring the overall quality of the output in terms of how it's taking forward the discipline, and its general, you know, contribution to knowledge. But you're also measuring the impact of that research outside the university, in the what we sometimes kind of falsely call the real world, and the environment for research that the university enables. So by increasing the impact and environment weighting, you get a much better sense of the changes, that research is making in the world to the economy, to society, to the general kind of public health and well-being. And the combined impact of those changes seems to be, as I said, that we've got this enormous, like, great spread of excellence. And you can see, you know, we've seen in the past little pockets of excellence, you know, in universities where you might not necessarily, if you weren't paying very close attention, expect it. And we're seeing quite a lot more of that. And that's, I think, is really good news for anyone who's a fan of kind of the place and levelling up agenda. And keen to kind of continue to advance the idea that research, you know, should where possible be impactful. Of course, on the site today, DK has all the data you need, and there'll be more commentary coming out throughout the day, in the weeks and months ahead. So, keep an eye out for that.
So it's a bit of a different flavour this year, isn't it? Isn't it, Sean? I mean, there's a bit less game playing, and possibly a bit less heat on who's up and who's down, because things have changed quite a bit since last time, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. So, well, first of all, massive congratulations to everybody involved in REF 2021. And as Debbie said, it's absolutely fantastic to see right across the sector that 4-star and 3-star research, including my colleagues here in Northampton. So congratulations to all of them. It was designed to be less game playing, and I know that's a real challenge on these exercises because, you know, give academics something that can be measured and they'll find a way to game play it. But I do think this is robust, it is peer evaluated, it's objective, and I think actually we should be really proud as a sector of these the consequences, the outcomes of REF, and really hold our head high about it. And as you said, I think not much game playing here. Of course, there's a lot of bunching in the middle, so people will be, you know, rubbing shoulders, saying, you know, I'm up two places, down two places. And I think we need to be quite careful about interpreting the league tables, because actually very, very small differences in outcomes produced will produce league table swings. And I think overall, there's a lot of information in there. And of course, we'll be processing it over the coming year as we get more information about how the decisions were made. But I think it's a really good show. And of course, it was a year late coming out. And so we're very pleased to see it now.
It's also worth, I think, it's worth noting, actually, one of the things that I think will come out. So there'll be another batch of insight in the summer where there'll be a lot more kind of detail behind as Sean says, behind these decisions. And one of the kind of hints that we've had in some of the briefings is that there's a really interesting story to tell about interdisciplinary research. And I mean, that's always been something that the REF has kind of struggled to deal with, because of course we've got these kind of well-defined subject areas, units of assessment. And this REF, it seems that, you know, they've been making real efforts to think about how do we assess research that crosses disciplines. And I think one of the implications is, of course, is that when you've got really good interdisciplinary research, you can really demonstrate impact because you're bringing together people from different disciplinary areas to solve interesting problems. So I think we'll be really looking forward to finding out what that looks like and how that's panned out. The other thing I suppose we should be looking out for in the weeks ahead is lots of discussion about whether the REF is worth it. And, you know, whether this exercise, which, you know, obviously does kind of create a lot of heat and light at the time that it happens, is kind of overly burdensome. And we had the sort of not unexpected commentary from Joe Grady at UCU saying that it's a sort of very problematic exercise and very expensive and burdensome and, you know, not very helpful in terms of kind of academic experience and that sort of thing. So I imagine we're going to be seeing quite a lot of debate about the future of the REF. Whether it's value for money. And there's a rather nice little piece on the site that we published earlier this week from Jonathan Grant, Five Myths About the REF, where he, sort of defends it against accusations of kind of burdensome and expenditure and that there might be more efficient ways to do it, which is very much worth a look.
So just back to the point about game playing, I think the games are going to start with the league tables and, everywhere competing to be, top in a particular angle of it. So as we see people, debating whether, 4-star research should be the measure or grade point average, or some other way of doing it, we'll probably find that everywhere's got a claim as to be top of the league table in some way.
There are some also interesting trends to consider, aren't there? So, performance of universities outside of London, for example, particular strengths in places like Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester, and Newcastle, Northumbria. So there's a sort of, the government could possibly claim a bit of a levelling up win when it comes to how this REF has played out, couldn't they?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's good to keep that story pressing forward. And we're going to come on in a minute and talk about widening access. But I do think, showing that students all over the country from any region have access to higher education that's informed by international quality research, and then those universities are having conversations with employers, industry, professions, again, the law profession, as Carl said earlier, that all universities can engage from a research position with the outside world, I think is a really important story as part of levelling up.
I think also there's quite an important thing here about university coordination and collaboration at a regional level as well, because, you know, research, we know research is an ecosystem. And, you know, so much of the government's agenda around the research and development roadmap, you know, UKRI's recent strategy is about thinking about what is the contribution of different kinds of universities in, you know, in places to, you know, to particular areas of strength and innovation and kind of potential for, you know, for economic transformation and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, where we can kind of mine these findings to say, well, actually, we can see some patterns of excellence that are not, you know, that are less related to kind of individual institutions and are more related to people coming together to do interesting things in places, that can only be really positive for the kind of for the science, you know, to become a science superpower.
And we totally argue that, you know, universities are key to regional regeneration, and being a place that attracts industry in that region. So yes, this is a really important part of that narrative.
I think it's important not to lose sight of the overarching message, which is that 84% of assessed research is either world leading or internationally excellent. So our university sector is doing a tremendous job on a small amount of resource and internationally comparable to any other university sector. So congratulations to everyone.
Quite right. I think one of the other interesting things is the, I mean, a lot is being made about this in the kind of the initial hot takes, but the slight breaking of the golden triangle. I mean, it's hardly been smashed, but there are, you know, there is definitely a slightly more spreading out of excellence in a way that is, you know, not probably some sections of the Russell Group might be unhappy with, but that's a really interesting trend, isn't it? I mean, particularly the power of the small and specialists is really, really notable, aren't they, Debbie?
Yes, I think, and I suppose the things, you know, it's quite easy to be kind of, I guess, uncomplicatedly celebratory at this point in the cycle when the funding starts getting allocated and it's seen what the impact of that is. I think, you know, I think the overall funding envelope is slightly larger than it has been in the past. So that will, I think, help to relieve some of the kind of pressures of feeling like the whole thing is a zero sum game. But yes, it wouldn't be surprising to see, for example, some large research intensive universities sort of saying this is actually going to be quite problematic in terms of the distribution of resource. And I guess, you know, that some of that will unfold in the weeks ahead. And it's just a question of whether the government and policymakers are kind of sympathetic to those sorts of arguments. And whether it's perceived to be worth making them in a context when, of course, you know, the agenda is very focused on
yeah, leveling up. You know, that brings me on to another thought, which was, you know, what the government says about genuine now evidence research excellence in areas that they, you know, really don't like very much and don't want to spend a lot of money on. I'm thinking, you know, creative industries, for example, but there's lots of other examples. We've got evidence here that shows there's absolutely some fantastic stuff that goes on also on often in unexpected places as well. So is it, Sharna, a bit awkward for the government to have this?
Well, one of the things I think is university missions extend beyond the terms of government. So I think it's really important for us to keep a sight, you know, stewardship of these important areas of culture and learning. And of course, industry. I mean, you know, millions of pounds in cultural industries across the country. But I think it is a good news story because they are under threat. And part of the reason is we've been struggling to attract students into some of these areas. So I think anything that highlights the value, importance, success, vibrancy of culture, arts and humanities in universities and in industry is a good thing.
I think as well, it's important to remember, because of course research sits in Bayes under George Freeman as minister, and of course, you know, and the devolved administrations as well. So what one minister over at DfE might be saying about, you know, saber-rattling about, you know, low-quality courses and all the rest of it and kind of worrying about graduate outcomes in some areas, it probably isn't the same as what the kind of policy thinking is in Bayes, because I think it's quite well understood in that kind of part of government that, you know, you really do need a good disciplinary spread if you're going to achieve the sort of outcomes that they really want to see. And, you know, we used to hear David Bullitts, when he was science minister as well as universities minister, talk about STEAM and the important, you know, that an overly narrow focus on STEM would actually kind of miss an awful lot of really high value necessary work that you know that will contribute to solving the world's problems. So I think that's perhaps more understood in that part of government than perhaps in some other parts.
So I mean, there'll be lots of people listening to this podcast. Probably they might be in the ref themselves, or they work in universities, and they'll say, well, you know, it's sort of understand why research has to be measured in some way to justify spending on it. Although some would probably also argue that it shouldn't be. I'm sort of interested to get your take, all of you actually, about kind of where we've got to on this question. The ref has always been quite unpopular amongst the rank and file academics. But there's a tension between, you know, obviously those who have to, as I say, justify the spending on research and the unintended consequences of what it does in terms of, how universities are managed, how resources are planned and the rest of it. Where have we got to with this?
Well, Mark, I think we should look at it with an analogy to learning and teaching and assessment and think about it as formative and summative assessment. So a summative approach gives you a league table position, for example. So, I think there's probably quite a lot to challenge about that. But a formative approach tells you how you're doing against a set of very robust criteria as your peers have assessed you, and it allows you to make plans and build on your strengths and address areas for development for your next cycle. And we would be very remiss if we weren't doing some kind of evaluation of this. You know, huge amount of work goes into it, huge amount of funding goes into it. Of course we should want to know where we're doing well, where we could do better. And I think the other thing that REF has done really successfully is drive change around equality and inclusion and other kinds of practices. I think if you look at it through a lens of what does the REF drive in terms of change, self-knowledge, improvement, collaboration, as Debbie said earlier, I think those are all really good things.
Well, the issue is taxpayer getting value for money. 84% of research is world-leading or internationally excellent. Look what's happened in the pandemic with the rollout of vaccines developed by our universities. I think the British taxpayer can be very proud of its university sector.
I think it's fair to say that so much of that, I think Shan is completely right. When you're trying to drive kind of policy and change at a national level, there's always going to be, you're going to see some kind of positive outcomes in terms of behaviours, and you're going to see some more problematic ones. But that doesn't mean that the exercise itself is kind of fundamentally flawed. It means that sometimes people's interpretation or the implementation of the exercise in their institutional context is having unforeseen impacts. So I think, I think it is probably fair to say, and I think, our colleague Sunday Blake is gathering some of these stories to share on the site a bit later today or tomorrow, where, at an early career stage, researchers can feel under an enormous amount of pressure to kind of produce, refable outputs. And that does have consequences. Likewise, I think that there's a sort of, we know from kind of work that's been undertaken on research culture that, the pressure can produce a kind of spirit of like hyper-competitiveness, which can lead to, sort of bullying and some toxic behaviours. I think, the challenge there is to really address those cultures, and for institutions to think really carefully about how they approach the REF and whether they approach it, as Shan says, in the spirit of formative assessment, development, and an opportunity to improve, or they approach it as this kind of, horrendous kind of hyper-competitive zero-sum sort of experience, and with a knock-on impact on the academic experience. And I think it's perfectly possible, it should be perfectly possible to focus on the former and try and stamp out the kind of worst aspects of the latter.
So as Debbie says, you can find links in the show notes to all our analysis of the REF results on wonky.com. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Nick Mount. I'm Academic Director at the University of Nottingham Online. Now, like many universities post-pandemic, my own is beginning to realise some of the new opportunities in digital and online learning, and it can see even more opportunities coming down the line in that area with the lifelong loan entitlement, which is going to help us diversify our offer and enhance the flexibility and personalisation of our learning. And I guess micro-credential learning is looking like it's going to be absolutely at the heart of that. And that's going to represent an enormous change that's already proliferating new learning products. It's a change that's going to be backed by significant government funding by 2025. But I think that micro-credential learning is challenging fundamental ideas of what university study is, how we should conceive and structure it, how that sort of learning should be designed, produced, and in particular, quality assured. I'm not convinced that the incremental change approach we usually see in institutions that govern those areas when faced with significant challenge is going to be able to get us where we need to be quickly enough to respond. So my blog is a call to the sector to be open to rethinking its approaches to learning design and assurance for this new world of micro-credentials. And I'm suggesting we put detailed, robust learning design front and centre in that debate, rather than letting it be something that emerges as some sort of afterthought, which I think ultimately will reduce the quality that learners experience.
So it was the Queen's Speech this week, and we got the news that there's going to be a new higher education bill. Carl, walk us through it.
So the Queen's Speech sets out the agenda for new legislation over the course of this new parliament. It was delivered by Prince Charles in the Queen's absence. It set out that the government aims to pass over four times the amount of legislation it did in the last parliament, a very ambitious agenda. And it includes a new higher education bill to pick up from the consultations that have just closed last week on the lifelong loan entitlement. And of course, we've got the returning Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill that I know wonky listeners love to hear about.
Yes, for more on that, see last week's episode. So I think there's a few things here. I mean, we knew that the government obviously been consulting on minimum eligibility requirements and number controls. But I guess, Debbie, we weren't expecting that to be wrapped up into a big, shiny new bill, were we?
No, we were certainly expecting legislation on the lifelong loan entitlement. But what it looks like is going to happen is that some of the consequences of the proposals from the HE reform consultation just closed, that included things like the introduction of student number controls and minimum eligibility requirements for student loans, may feature in that legislation as well. And it's also, I guess, it is an opportunity, isn't it, for things like, with the post-16 skills and education bill, we saw, amendments put in around banning essay or restricting the activities of essay mills. So it is, once you've got a bill kind of that does a few different things, you've got an opportunity to kind of wedge in any kind of current preoccupations and concerns that might be of issue at the time. So it is, I think the other thing, of course, about a bill on a slightly larger scale, although it is of course concerning because the sector is no friend to either student number controls or minimum eligibility requirements, but it does create an opportunity for extended legislative process, lots of opportunity for conversations, for development, for things to be kind of discussed in depth. And I think that is when it comes to those sorts of measures around restricting or trying to reshape access to different kinds of higher education can only be a good thing, because we know that there's policymakers are not of one single mind on this on some of these matters, as we saw from the consultation itself, which was extremely open. So my only hope really is that I get back from my maternity leave in time to get involved in the conversation, because I think it's going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah, I guess we're not expecting the bill to be published imminently, are we? Because that consultation is only just closed. Although it does somewhat indicate that they are, they're minding to plough ahead with things like number controls and other things that need the need primary legislation, despite virtually everyone in the sector saying please don't. Otherwise, they wouldn't have scheduled this bill, would they? So, I think that's probably a bad sign. The other thing that I worry about is once there's a bill is, all the other things that might go alongside with it. I mean, what this government doesn't have is a big coherent strategy of higher education reform. What it's doing is tinkering around the edges. But once a bill starts its way going through Parliament, who knows what weird amendments and things are gonna happen.
I think that's absolutely right, because I think we've got a lot of contradictions at the heart of this. And one is, I think, there's three different issues going on around entry requirements, standards of qualifications, graduate employment outcomes, and kind of consumer demand for higher education. And they all pull in different directions. And I don't think the government hasn't, it veers off in different, follows different tracks down that, but they don't gel into a coherent strategy. So as we were talking earlier about the levelling up agenda, which is obviously completely at odds with the contraction of higher education based on perception of costs and arguments about who can benefit. So I think there are risks in this, as you've said, but I think if we can continue to focus on making sure that entry requirements, graduate employment opportunities and demand for higher education are seen as three separate things that have to be resolved in different ways and not just see the government use that as a way to contract higher education that damages the progress towards levelling up.
Mm. I guess the flip side of that is that by putting those things on the agenda in Parliament, we could have an interesting debate about the shape and size of higher education, and there's an opportunity for the sector to lobby local MPs and others, and particularly in the House of Lords, when it comes to it, to actually defend what universities do.
Yeah, I think that's totally
more of a
right.
comment, more of a comment than a question. But yeah,
I was really interested to see the areas of the measures on renters reform as well, and protect duty of public spaces, because through COVID we're very conscious of the difference of experience of students in private accommodation compared to university accommodation, and I think anything that kind of addresses those inequalities is to be welcomed.
Apprenticeships, I thought the Queen's speech, the notes the government issued, seemed to be suggesting that they've got it wrong on the apprenticeship levy, that they're going to have another look at that and look at ways to get greater private investment into skills training and technical training. So that was under the apprenticeships section. That for me looked very interesting. There's also a piece around the Digital Markets Competition and Consumer Bill. Every university advertises on Google, Facebook, etc., and the government recognizes that there's probably 2.4 billion per year lost to consumers because of the anti-competitive behavior of Google and Facebook. So that would help with the unit costs that universities have. I also thought there was some interesting information about part-time students, a recognition that many part-time students are put off coming to university because of the cost of provision. Maybe the lifelong loan entitlement will give us that opportunity. And I'd really encourage universities to engage with the lifelong loan entitlement. It's a shame that government only looks at things in the way of loans instead of looking at the taxation system to enable people who invest in their own career to be able to deduct that as a taxable expense. A self-employed person or a company can do that, but an employee can't. So I thought there were some other things as you read through the information. On the renters reform bill, I didn't think it went far enough. Creating a new ombudsman for private landlords, yeah, but it doesn't really go far enough for me. And on the freedom of speech higher education bill, I mean, it's really poorly drafted. As a lawyer, I've sort of unpicked it for a review. And what I think is missing is really an understanding that freedom of speech works best if there is respect for people who express their opinions. And the legislation doesn't seek to give any recognition that universities need to respect somebody once they express their opinion. It's all about employment protection rights, so I'm sure that the legislation will be used to harass employers. And it's all about student unions making sure that their facilities are available for people to express their opinion. But what's missing at the heart of our society is a respect for people when they express their opinion. You're either shouted down, you have protesters gluing themselves to something that they disagree with, and that's really the issue. And it stems from members of parliament who call one another scum, who are not setting a good example. And I think legislation is great, but it's not going to solve the problem. Respect is missing.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what we've been arguing is that, you know, the problem is cultural, which is not something you can really fix with legislation. And, you know, this is a bit of a, treading old ground in some ways, but I do think that, it's, the models of debate that we have as you say, Carl, are just not very productive in terms of educating, developing understanding, building common ground, helping people see things from other perspectives. It is not a productive conversation. And I know one of the kind of really positive things universities are doing is thinking about how do we foster positive, meaningful conversations and disagree respectfully. And that seems to be the space where real change could be happening. And actually, in some ways, this legislation is going to make that even harder.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see the evidence base, if you like, that government has for this particular piece of legislation, which is the Policy Exchange Survey, showing that academic staff self-censored and wouldn't express an opinion because they didn't feel that their opinion would be well received. And I think that's essentially the issue, and it's not legislative, it's cultural, as you say. Mm.
And it's not only universities, it's everywhere, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Actually, a version of that we've got going on at the minute is, lots of freedom of information requests about our curriculum particularly. And we're really struggling with those because when we answer them, we find we're lambasted in the press for what we've said. And we're really trying to navigate, truthfully answering our freedom of information requests, but in a way that doesn't kind of open us up to negative headlines that are very difficult to respond to. So recent examples were... We got a history curriculum which covers a wide range of things, including descriptions of torture, and we alert students to that beforehand. But when the freedom of information request comes in, we find ourselves positioned in the press in a very negative way. So I think that absolutely goes to what Carl and Debbie were saying about culture of respect when something is said.
I reviewed an article last week, and the author suggested that students should have a contractual obligation to respect the opinion of others. Now, it's a neat concept. However, it's fraught with difficulty. I mean, what do you do if a student's in breach of contract?
But yes, is it enforceable? Surely that's one of the first things you learn in GCSE contracts.
but the legislation is giving a right to be able to bring a claim before a court for compensation for loss. Well, what loss do you have when you're just expressing an opinion? I mean, it's crazy that it gets to that level on law. And I welcome people thinking wider about how do we get respect into the debate. But it starts with politicians. It starts with our leaders respecting the law.
Right. All this season, we're working with the Association of University Administrators to bring you dispatches from the desks of hardworking HE professionals around the country. And this week, we caught up with Kelly Wolfe and Hugh Jones, who told us about mentoring in practice and why others should try it.
Hi, I'm Kelly Wolfe, Deputy Academic Registrar for Registry Services at the University of Roehampton and the AUA Advocate for Roehampton.
Hi, my name is Hugh Jones. I am a freelance higher education consultant, and I'm also the programme lead for the AUA Postgrad Certificate. We're working on the area of mentoring and presenting at AUA conference about it because we both think it's a really useful activity for people to engage in. So I've been mentoring Kelly for a couple of years now, and it's something which I get a lot out of. I think Kelly does too. And it's a way to help everybody see the world through somebody else's eyes, which is a rare treat, but also to, from the mentor's perspective, help someone grow, help someone achieve their potential, which is great.
Well, the best thing for me about being in a mentoring arrangement with Hugh has first of all been approaching him and asking him to be my mentor. I think that's probably the smartest thing I've ever done in my career to date, but really using him as a sounding board and being able to come to him with daily queries, HE sector queries, and most importantly, I think for me, getting his advice and support along the way as I pursued promotion and landing the promotion in the end. So that certainly has been a very good thing in my career so far.
There's also challenges to mentoring. I think the biggest challenge that I've found, and it comes particularly from the mentor's perspective, is thinking about the kind of tone to set. It can be tempting to directly make suggestions. Do that, do this. And of course, people don't learn that way. You need to remember that often the best way to help someone learn for themselves and find out for themselves is to ask hard questions, be a bit of a critical friend, lead them somewhere, but remember it's their journey, not your journey. And so I think making the tone right, and that applies in management just as much as in mentoring, is a really important thing to do.
I'd say anyone looking at mentoring, really, I'd have a few top tips for you. So first of all, get yourself a mentor if you don't have one already, or somebody to mentor. Put yourself out there. If you don't have access to a formal scheme like the AUA's mentoring scheme, then there are other ways you can approach senior people in your institution. Ask for introductions. You know, if you want to mentor other people, you can also make it known that you are happy to coach people, and you'd be surprised that, you know, there may be just the right person, you know, waiting for that opportunity. Secondly, make sure you use that time wisely. Everyone is busy, and respecting your mentor's time by being prepared to talk about something, or, you know, using the time in the way it's meant instead of frittering it away, absolutely essential. And finally, being yourself, being completely honest in that relationship, and, you know, not wanting to worry about impressing them with your prowess and your knowledge, but being clear and honest about where you're at and what you need, and where you have made mistakes and how you can learn from them and how you can learn together along the way is, again, absolutely essential to getting the most out of a mentoring relationship.
Kellyanne Hu will be speaking at the AUA annual conference at the University of Manchester on 7th and 8th of July. You can find a link in the show notes or find out more at aua.ac.uk. Now, earlier in the week, I caught up with John Blake, the new Director for Fair Access and Participation at the Office for Students, at our Access All Areas event in London. And he had a lot to say. Here's a clip.
Clearly, their financial support is part of the APP process and one of the things to consider, and it will be part of the new cycle. I know, so I don't know if Jim Dickinson is now here, but I did read with interest his article about the APP variations and what we asked for and what we didn't ask for. And it did make me reflect that, I mean, I genuinely read Ronki every day. I love it. But I do feel that I could announce that every HE provider should give every student a bag of gold. And there would half an hour be later a Jim Dickinson article that sort of said, has John Blake considered the terrible impact this will have on inflation? So I think there's not an infinite array of things we could have considered in the variations, but clearly cost of living and an appropriate financial support is one of the things the APP process is there to do and to weigh up. And I think we will look at that. I think the evidence on bursaries is sketchy, though, the amount of difference they make and how they endure. And I think we need to think very carefully about what the shape and form of that support package can look like, should look like, and where that is most effective. And I think we also have to acknowledge that, yes, there are risks to equality of opportunity in provider. So, you know, it is acute and obvious when students are struggling in that way. But we all have a responsibility to think about risk to quality of opportunity also much earlier. So there is, you can't just pick one phase and be like, well, I'm going to pour everything into that. Otherwise, you know, the whole piece doesn't hang together.
But what would you say to government, particularly on the financial support side of things? I mean, there needs to be some tools, right, to support students. And this is a missing piece of the puzzle right now.
I think we'll see what comes out of the consultation responses to the Augar review. I think the APP process is a key part of thinking about what that support process looks like and what work the universities are doing in that. And we will regulate as we go forward in that. I think it's perfectly legitimate for the HE sector to go back to government and seek a conversation about that as it goes forward. But again, I don't want to prejudge any of that. And it isn't, you know, we are not here as the OFS, as the spokespeople of the sector. The sector has quite enough spokespeople who can get quite enough ear of the minister if they need it. What we are interested in is what is most effective across the whole life cycle of students.
Sean, there's a lot in this. What jumped out at you?
Well, one of the things I thought was really refreshing was the way John Blake was looking at what universities can learn from schools and colleges. And I know we've been in the discussion about potentially universities supporting or helping schools and colleges from a widening access angle, which I think we were struggling with, first of all, to see how that was resourced, but also where the expertise was, particularly to help schools and colleges do what they needed to do. But John Blake looked at it from the other angle and suggested that schools and colleges were doing interesting and useful things with data and evidence that universities could learn from. And I think that's absolutely true. I think a more metrics-based approach to understanding student achievement and which students are progressing and succeeding is something that we've moved forward on, but we could continue to do more with. So I thought that was absolutely true, and I was really fascinated as well by the suggestion that we needed more routes in and out of higher education. Again, I thought that was actually framed very productively, following student demand. And as we move into legislation around the lifelong learning entitlement, I think John Blake's angle on how we work with third sector and with employers and industry to understand pathways through higher education and to careers for students will continue to evolve. So I thought there were definitely areas there that we should look forward to exploring further.
Yeah, yeah. And he was pretty frank, actually, most of the time. I mean, obviously, he's not going to be able to disagree with the government or his employers at OFS. But he did admit that the DfE lacks tools to deal with the cost of living crisis for students. I think his words were they're currently missing, which, I mean, that's about as far as anyone we've heard go when it comes to this issue at this sort of level, isn't it, Debbie?
Yeah, and I think the kind of the elephant in the room at the minute when it comes to access really is that, you know, is about affordability, and you know, and that's really not a question of about, you know, the fee levels and you know, and it's really not about kind of university bursaries and either, because we're not talking kind of sufficient money there to really kind of, you know, change behaviours. It's about the fact that, you know, energy costs are rising, you know, students' families will be struggling, you know, more people will be in poverty over the next, you know, couple of years if the cost of living crisis continues in its current trajectory. I was talking, you know, this is a great thing about going to in-person events, you know, you can hear the bad news in person. I was talking to a colleague who grew up on a farm, and she said that her dad's been kind of getting in touch and saying, you know, we haven't even seen the beginning of the impact on things like the price of grain. You know, it's sort of set to quintuple in the months ahead. And of course, you know, that makes a difference in terms of people's level of confidence, in terms of their sort of sense of their freedom to make choices. And of course, universities work incredibly hard to try and make things accessible. But if students can't draw down on kind of sufficient maintenance support, as you know, as the Ogre report recommended, you know, really that this should really be looked at, and that maintenance support should be tied to the national living wage. If students can't access that, then, you know, that there's a real question of how are they going to live. And if they do manage to enrol in a university course, you know, they're making choices between heating and eating, as someone at the event very wisely pointed out. And of course, the consequences in terms of their ability to engage and be successful is enormous. And you know, and of course, John is completely right to point out that, you know, OFS can't really do much with that, and DfE has kind of limited influence as well, because it's a question for Treasury. But there is, you know, so that is going to be a real challenge, and something that the universities will certainly kind of start to see pressure on hardship bursaries and loans and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
And it's not entirely clear what the solution is.
Carl, I'm fascinated to know how you're grappling with the kind of access and participation regime at Arden.
Yeah, I mean, look, just for me to comment on the maintenance loans, I think the issue that nobody seems to grapple is that 2/3 of a maintenance loan, at least, is going to go on student accommodation. And if you look at the student accommodation costs, they've risen way above the rate of inflation over the last two decades. As the sector has become professionalised and offers more
You know, some of the large accommodation providers have a margin of 71% profit, and even in COVID, 61%. So some of that needs to be looked at. Government could legislate that universities have to provide lower cost accommodation on campus for students rather than requiring them to or giving them the ability to go out to the large commercial providers. Now, a university like Arden tries to limit the amount of days in which a student has to come into university. Deal with students who are average age in their 30s, and they usually have caring responsibilities or work commitments. So we're a different kind of university. As I look at the speech that and the interview that you did, Mark, with the director for Fair Access, what I found a little bit disappointing was that it was a focus on 18-year-olds, and it's very much looking at schools. I set up a multi-academy trust with the now chief executive of Ofqual. It was the most bureaucratic experience I've ever had. It was really difficult to do and to get involved in. You know, that is something that I'm not sure universities will necessarily want to get involved with, but I take the point that metrics there will help to improve things. We should also recognize that we've done a tremendous job in improving access and participation, and rightly so, the concentration should be now on getting people through the degrees and into great jobs. I mean, I myself am a vice chancellor. I was brought up by a single parent. I received free school meals. I went to a comprehensive. I was the first in my family ever to go to university. There are lots of people like me in the university sector. We give so much back, and we try to offer these opportunities to other people. So, I welcome the focus of the new director. I thought there was too much focus on 18-year-olds. I understand why, because that's the large chunk of people going to university. But don't give up on the older people. Don't give up on those who are studying part-time and looking for different routes.
Well, I mean, if I think about it, one of the things that might be worth universities considering, because of course the labour market is reasonably buoyant at the minute for a host of complicated reasons. I mean, so, you know, the service industry is struggling to get staff. And so I think one of the kind of consequences inevitably of the cost of living crisis is going to be that more students are doing part-time work and alongside, or possibly even full-time work alongside their studies. And that may be something that, you know, that is something that, lots of universities are kind of experienced at handling, but that is something that universities can actively respond to, and be aware of. And I think particularly in the context of thinking about, the interrelationship of work and study, which I think applies in different ways at different points, for different age groups. It struck me that, that John was suggesting that one of the things the higher education sector could usefully do is sort of think about the enormous amount of expertise that we have on careers, information, advice, and guidance, and perhaps think about extending that into schools and colleges. But I can absolutely imagine into workplaces through employer engagement as well, and really disseminating that kind of sense of where does education sit on your overall career journey,
and Debbie,
how those two things relate to each other.
Sorry, at the same time as you're saying that people are studying and working, the flexibility that, for example, online learning provides a student is not something that government wants to recognise. In fact, they're going to fine universities if they carry on with their online lectures. It's a very contradictory approach.
Right, so that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks very much to Debbie, Sian, Carl, and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.